So my name is Joaquin Cienfuegos. I'm a member of Cop Watch LA, the Peace Cooperative, and the Native Youth Movement. And I've been part of different organizations throughout my time in LA, or just organizing since I was 17. So.
And can you describe the trajectory of your activism and political consciousness that led to your organizing now?
Well, basically, the reason why I'm an organizer now is, or the reason why I'm in the movement today, is because of my own personal experiences growing up in South Central Los Angeles, and also spending some time in Fresno, California, which is the Central Valley of California, and mainly like farm working town, and just my overall experiences with racism and police. You know, that led me to basically look at things more critically. Also, like when just growing up in South Central around the time of like the 1992 rebellion after the police brutalized Rodney King, I was like 9 years old at the time, but I knew that, you know, there was that the police had done something wrong and the people were angry out of, you know, and it was righteous, you know. Also, at that time there was Proposition 187 in California, which was like an anti-immigration law that had passed, and that had just thrown most of my family into politics, because, you know, I mean, like it was gonna basically affect anybody who was not only undocumented, but anybody who was had migrated from Mexico or Central America, you know, and a lot of people in Los Angeles, you know. So that kind of like helped politicize me and see that the U.S. wasn't a democratic society and was also a racist society, you know. And throughout the years, kind of like just my run-ins with the police since I was 13 years old, and getting kicked out of school for challenging my teachers, kind of forced me to like kind of read some history and just analyze things. And I first identified like as an anarchist, I would say, just reading about the Mexican Revolution and in Cabo Flores Magón in particular. And then also, you know, around the time of the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, it was some huge demonstrations in LA, and those were some of the first ones I had went to, and around like immigrant rights as well and police brutality. So after that, kind of like I got recruited by this communist organization, the RCP. They were the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the reason why I kind of ended up joining them was because they were doing work around police brutality and immigrant rights, and it kind of attracted a lot of youth of color. And there was a lot of youth of color organizing in that party. But just always had questions, and just seeing how they were structured and seeing that the leadership was white, middle class male, and just was a reflection of the same society, you know, and they kind of like would get defensive when people would challenge that. And most of the people of color in the organization were just doing the footwork for them. So after seeing that, I left when I was like 21, and, you know, started organizing on, you know, like, I guess anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist projects, you know. And we started different organizations from projects that led to where I'm at now, you know.
Can you give a history of your involvement with Cop Watch in LA?
So I mentioned how, like, when I left, I was involved in different anarchist projects. We started the Southern California Collective Network, and it was just kind of like a anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian organization of like different young working class youth of color throughout Los Angeles that were like identified as anarchists, but we didn't want to like put it in the name, like, and it was a way to kind of like gather some like anarchists or people in general to kind of build a revolutionary organization, and which led to the building of the LA chapter of SCAF, which was the Southern California Anarchist Federation. And we had chapters in different cities, different areas of Southern California. In LA, basically did the work was through the projects or the collectives that came out of SCAF LA. And one of the things that I was involved in was Cop Watch LA. And just because LA, if you look at its history and just our experiences in general, is like, you know, I mean, we're dealing with like heavy police, like terrorism and police violence and police occupation, you know. So it was if you organize in LA, you don't really, if you're involved in community organizing and you don't do any work around police brutality, then you're not, in my opinion, you're not really gonna reach people. So we formed Cop Watch LA in different projects, And after, like, there was some internal stuff in SCAF LA where, like, some other chapters felt like they had more, they were going to tell us what to do instead of having, like, some autonomy in the chapters, which was what we envisioned. The Orange County chapter, which was mainly, like, white and middle class and male, would come, and we had, like, a gathering, and they would come, they came and tried to tell, like, some of the women of color and some of the youth of color, like, what to do. And if we're not trying to give the oppressed kind of like a voice to for them to like have their own vision, then, you know, I mean, we're not really building anything different, and it's not really different from, for me, it wasn't going to be any different from like the RCP or those organizations, you know. So a lot of we decided to like kind of like leave SCAF because those people didn't take those politics seriously, or our voice seriously, or the work that we were doing, because we were doing way more than they were. Not to say like, oh, it was a competition, but, you know, I think that a lot of the work that we were doing was community based, you know. So we felt that we needed to create a different type of organization at that point. There was and the funny thing is that in SCAF LA, in LA in general, most anarchists are people of color. Mm. You know, I mean, which is probably different from any other city. So even like people say, oh, we don't really need an APOC here in LA because, you know, we're all pretty much POC. Even though we're part of the APOC network, like, they were like, well, you know, we don't need to have our own space because all our organizations are pretty much mainly like people of color. Unless some folks move from out of town, and, you know, there's some white folks that move there from out of town, and they're white, you know, and they're anarchists. So after SCAF LA basically like disbanded at that point, for those reasons.
I'm sorry, disbanded mostly because of the tensions between?
It wasn't just tensions, I think it was like the politics, you know. Mm. It was political differences, because of the folks didn't really want to deal with like race. They didn't want to have a race analysis or talk about the oppression of women and sexuality and things like that, that a lot of people in SCAF LA felt was important. To some extent, they were like class reductionists, you know. Some, not all of them, I'm still really close with a lot of the old SCAF folks in Orange County and other places, but some people that felt like they had leadership in the organization, that they had ownership, you know. Felt that they needed to impose on us, and that was one of the key things too, like their approach, you know, and methods, and just the way they wanted to structure things wasn't aligned with our vision. So we felt we need to step back and kind of like disband, and at that point we focused more on the projects in LA that came out of it. Like, there was a women's collective called Mujeres Libres, Cop Watch LA, there was a labor collective for a moment too, and then the youth collective that was in SCAF was part of Cop Watch. And the idea was to eventually create another organization, like, because we felt that Cop Watch is not enough, you know, I mean, it's enough just to Cop Watch, we need to connect it to a larger movement. So the idea was to form another anti-imperialist organization, revolutionary organization, but that was made up specifically of people of color and working class people and people who are directly affected by it, and would be exclusively made up by the oppressed, you know. Mm-hmm. The reason being is not that, you know, we want to exclude anybody per se, but like, we're excluded all the time, you know, and we're told what to do and how to liberate ourselves, you know, and they're, that, you know, we're told by people with privilege that, you know, they're gonna tell us how to do it, you know. So we felt that we need to do, you know, create our own strategy, our own vision and approach and organization, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's when, shortly after that, we created RAC, which is the Revolutionary Autonomous Communities, which I was part of as well. And they're still connected to Cop Watch, still work together. Like, Cop Watch itself, too, was a people of color organization, patrolled in their own neighborhood. Like, it was Long Beach and South Central, there were the two communities that first kind of like were made of Cop Watch. After that, different communities started get training and started to do the Cop Watching too, and be part of the Cop Watch like overall like organization, which was like East LA, and people that were doing it in downtown LA, because we started working with as well, and like in Skid Row area, the east, I guess, downtown east side. and also Boyle Heights, Pico Union, Echo Park, some of the areas, and basically now it's Orange County, parts of Orange County too, Santa Ana, which is like mainly like 75% like Spanish speaking community in Orange County. And it was just a way that our motto was that, you know, if you don't live in that neighborhood or you're not invited to that neighborhood, that you shouldn't be doing patrols there, because you're not facing the repercussions, you know, or you're not, you, if you patrol there and you just leave after, you know, you're not really building one, you're not really building a relationship with people that live there, and you're probably just bringing down some heat on them and not really being held accountable, you know.
So can I ask what your specific organizing model is for Cop Watch, and how is it that organizing model has been, you know, so attractive to different communities?
I think the thing made it attractive was that, one, like, I think it was direct action, you know? I guess you can say, like, preventative, quote-unquote. Like, I think for the most part in L.A., or just in general, activists just wait for something to happen and just react, you know what I mean? They just wait for the state to come down on people and react to it, have a demonstration or press conference or whatever. In my opinion, it's already played out, you know, and it's overused, a lot of these tactics. And Cop Watch L.A. felt that we need to do something before it happens, and basically take direct action to stop police brutality from happening in general, you know. But we felt and we understood it was going to be a process. We had short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals for the organization, you know, and the vision overall. And our motto was a direct democratic model. It was just horizontal, you know, and it was kind of like a federation. If you really think about it, it's like delegates from each chapter would send people to the meetings, and basically we network with each other, support each other, give training, resources, and support. And that was the role of Cop Watch LA. And this still is, you know what I mean? Basically, our idea is that everybody can go out there and do this work. And the idea for Cop Watch LA is to just become like a way that we can support people, give training, resources, and just share our experiences with them, so they can be successful and safe in doing this type of work, and kind of creating a culture of people taking action and observing the police. In the words of Huey P. Newton, like, where people can watch the police. What he said was they wanted to watch people from their windows, or people wanted created the communities where people watch the police from their windows with shotguns. And the idea was that, you know, they created like these communities where the police are not welcome, you know. And our idea was that we want to create liberated zones or liberated communities too, and work hand in hand with other people from all these different neighborhoods to take back our communities from the state. We definitely, in my opinion, we need to work also with indigenous communities in those territories, you know, because they're the original keepers of the land, you know.
So you mentioned in your talk yesterday that you feel that Cop Watch you know, is a tactic, mm-hmm. in context of revolutionary change, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering why you think it's revolutionary versus you know, it might be seen as, you know, reformist, as people just like, you know, recording police and perhaps trying to hold them accountable.
I guess it's how you do the work, you know. And if you're in my opinion, if you're just recording the police, if you're just like going out there to a demonstration, then it's not really any different. I mean, but it is a tactic that has been effective, though, and has been revolutionary in practice. Like, if you look at the history of cop watching, you know, down to like in the South of in the U.S. in the South, where the Deacons for Defense and Justice would go out and defend themselves from like racist ranchers, the KKK, and sheriffs. And the time that the NAACP was kind of like going the reformist route, they were like, "Well, no, we're gonna take a stand. You know, we're gonna defend ourselves." And you look at the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Los Angeles, would do the same thing. You know, they were proactive in stopping police brutality. Or the Black Panther Party learned from that. The American Indian Movement as well. These are organizations that had revolutionary aims, you know. And in my opinion, Cop Watch LA. Or cop watching is a tactic, and it's a self-defense tactic. If you really looking at it, in my opinion, it's a tactic in self-defense even though like now we're not in a situation where, you know, we can be like AIM or the BPP where we can be armed, you know, doing the patrols, the camera can be like tool in self-defense right now. Because if they see the camera, you know, usually they get put on the defensive. Or they just see an organized group of people confronting them, then they get put on the defensive because they're used to people being afraid of them or just looking the other way or not doing anything when they're harassing people. So if they see a group of people doing that, then it puts them on the defensive. Not only that, it provides an example, and most people, when they see that, you know, they're gonna get inspired. Hopefully they get inspired to do something similar and be part of this type of organizing, you know?
You also said in your talk yesterday that CopWatch is part of a vision, you know, of a world free of oppression. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, how does your organizing model, you know, talk about, you talked about it's like led by people of color. Yeah. And I'm wondering how your model addresses, you know, age, gender, right. Sexuality.
I think from the beginning, we try to address all forms of oppression. And we had like this, even the beginning of RAC, where, you know, like RAC was the space where we actually dealt with all these forms of oppression too. And we talked about it, and we're trying to have a campaign to name all the systems of oppression and kind of like popularize it with not only like the young people, the youth in our organization, but everybody in the community where they can like really see how things are connected and how they intersect. But so like that was part of the overall work of CopWatch. And it's not just to just talk about police brutality and the state, but actually look at how like it plays out in people's day-to-day life and the social relationships. Because in my opinion, I mean, you can overthrow the government, you can get rid of the police, but if those social relationships still exist, then we're not really changing anything. You know, I mean, if we get rid of the police today, we're still gonna have domestic violence. You know, what I mean, and we're still gonna have all these things because we haven't dealt with the overall, like, I guess like the socialization and the social relationships that come from colonialism and come from the system, but it's deeply ingrained in our society and it's deeply ingrained in our people and our communities. So I think it's a process now, you know, that people need to start talking about it and start dealing with it. And in terms of domestic violence, like we had a program in CopWatch LA where the women actually took the initiative to deal with it. You know, I mean, like they bump heads with other feminist organizations too, you know, that we're like, well, we need to rely on the police because they're helping the women and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, they didn't understand that we had a responsibility too, and we had to intervene and we had to take responsibility for our neighbors, you know, and our loved ones, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was the overall idea too, is that eventually, you know, we rely on ourselves for everything, and also meaning that we need, you know, we start healing each other and start dealing with the social relationships, you know, of the system. We come from these communities that are unhealthy, you know, and we can't come at the people with this like approach where we're better than them because we have the correct language or because, you know, whatever, we might be conscious, you know, because most people, you know, have most young people or young males, you know, even young women have like machismo, you know what I mean, or have you know what I mean, like sexism, mm-hmm. or homophobia, you know. So we understand that, you know, and we just gotta meet people where they're at, mm-hmm. and not where we want them to be. For me, like building relationships with like young people, like the more they trust you, and once they talk to you, like they start saying something that's sexist or whatever, or doing something that's sexist, then you can talk to them and not in a way that, you know, alienates them or pushes them away, but, you know, as a friend, you tell them, hey, you know, look, that's, you know, that's wrong because this and this and that. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, that's homophobic, or this is what homophobia is, and this is why we need to change all these things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think little by little, it has been changing. And the good thing is that there's an atmosphere in the movement in general where people are actually dealing with these things, you know, which makes it easier too for people in the communities, because they're, I guess, like if you're really out there and you're really engaged in the community, then people are already listening to that type of dialogue, mm-hmm. you know, or like anti-oppression politics and why it's important, mm-hmm. you know.
So this might be a bit of a complicated question, but when you talk about you organize by community, mm-hmm. How do you define community?
Okay, that's what we always get asked that.
Sorry.
It's good because, I mean, there's two, like we always talked about in SCAF too, in SCAF LA, there's two types of community, you know. It's one, there's community of region and community of identity, you know. And I think for us, you know, we do a little bit of both, but it's mainly like when we say community, we're talking about that specific region, that specific geographical region, you know, like a specific community where people like live in, you know. But it also has to do with community of identity, because, you know, because we are talking about anti-oppression politics, you know, and people see themselves as a part, maybe part of another community, even though they live in that specific community, they're part of different communities, right? Like there might be part of the Black community or the Indigenous community or whatever, you know. But we try to address the region because that's, you know, if you look at it, it has this, cultures like kind of like influence each other. You have South Central, for example, because of the 92 rebellion and because of people living, having to live next to each other for a long time, they build a lot of relationships. And you have a situation where Black folks listen to like rock en español, or like and where like you have Mexicans that are into Black culture or part of, even part of like blood gangs, you know, or Crip gangs or whatever, maybe more so like the blood gangs, you know. So you have the situation where like, yeah, culture influences each other and people kind of like, you know, hang out with each other more so in South Central than other parts of LA, because there's still like tensions, you know. Mm-hmm. But part of our work is to deal with that, you know, deal with those things and like Black and brown, to build Black and brown unity or unity amongst oppressed people.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about how, you know, people organize in their own community, and you seem to have like, you know, some guidelines around not going into other communities. But yeah. How does cross community organizing and solidarity work?
Well, I think that the idea is to build autonomy and solidarity. You know, I mean, that's the idea, right? Like learning from just movements, like for example, Zapatistas, but even like, you know, anarchists, they MACNO, the Ukrainian anarchists, you know what I mean? And, you know, revolutionary anarchism, for me, it's like also like looking at Indigenous communities, you know, and how they organize, you know. I mean, it's important to like looking at, for example, the Iroquois Confederation, you know, Federation of Iroquois Nations, and how like basically that's where like our model comes from, or even like anarchist models come from, right? Mm-hmm. Studying these Indigenous communities, so looking at those models and learning from them and trying to, they're still applicable today. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's part of the work that we're trying to do, is build autonomy, but at the same time have solidarity, or real, not just a name, but an action, you know? When I say solidarity, it means that we're actually taking action and together, you know, we're fighting for the same aims, the same goals, and we understand that, you know? And even though we have different, the reality is that different communities have different conditions, so that's why you can't just have one, I guess, try to fit one into all, because it's not gonna work, you know? But as long as we know we're fighting for the same goals, same aims, and we're sharing resources, mm-hmm. I think that's where the solidarity comes in. If we can share resources with different communities, then that's where it comes into play. Mm-hmm.
You know? And on that note of solidarity, and kind of going back to, you know, your experience with the RCP and also SCAF, and you know, what is the role of, you know, white revolutionaries or white allies? Maybe in Cop Watch, or
in Cop Watch. Well, we don't have white folks in Cop Watch.
Okay, as like a general rule.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've had in the past, and like some people have gotten angry. They're like, they cried. Some people, some like white people cried because they're like, oh, they don't want to let us in Cop Watch because we're white, you know. And I mean, the reality is that, you know, they have a lot of, not only do they have privilege, but they are trained in society to lead, you know. And once you come into, the more white people are in your organization, the more they're going to try to gravitate towards power, and the more they're going to like take things in a different direction. And we need to have our own space, you know what I mean? We need to have our own space to kind of like not only talk with each other, but actually, you know what I mean? Like, we have a different way of doing things too, and we need to like regain that. We need to regain our culture, and just the way that we organize reflects everything, you know? So I feel that, you know, there needs to be like folks that organize white people, for sure, and the white community needs to organize themselves. But it's not my role to go into the white community and tell them how they're going to organize themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are people I feel that see themselves as allies, you know, and they can do that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we can see like if we can fight together or not, you know. There's some people that might come in with this mentality still, like we call it the white messiah complex, that they're gonna, you know, they do that all the time. They come into like not only oppressed communities, Indigenous communities, I think here in Canada a lot, you know, they see that a lot, where they come in and try to tell people what to do, you know. And I don't think that's one of the reasons why there's a lot, I guess, distrust There's just not a lot of trust, basically, for like some white activists, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think they have to build that up, you know, and show that they're sincere, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah.
So, what have been the main barriers to organizing in CropWatch?
I think it's repression, of course. You know, that's mm-hmm. the easy answer. It's just like we understand that, you know, like doing this type of work, we're gonna get repression, and we've seen it. Two is just, again, just kind of like learning how to work with each other. And I think all of us have like internalized oppression, you know, and we're still dealing with that and learning how to work with each other at the same time, like work on ourselves, you know. And if you're not doing that, then we're not really creating a better world, because, you know, I mean, like, you got to work on yourself too, because we have internalized oppression, and we're dealing with colonialism, you know. And that reflects in everything. That reflects in your daily life, but also reflects in your political work, especially. So if you're not working on yourself, then you know, then that's a big deal, you know. So that's one thing. Another thing, and then also like learning, getting people to step up, you know, take responsibility. Like that's in any organizing, you know. I think people are taught to look to individuals to do everything for them and make decisions for them, you know, from the time they're born. They give authority to somebody else, and they, you know, then I think for some people it's just easier too, because, I mean, you know, like, you don't have to take responsibility, you know what I mean? And you don't have to do work, you know, because you can just say, oh, they're going to do it, you know, they'll do it for us, you know? And I think the, in RAC and in CopWatch LA, we've tried to do that, and we've tried to struggle with how can people step up. And I've tried to, you know, like, I've been an organizer in both of those organizations for a long time, you know, but because I have a son now too, like, I want to step back, and I'm part of other organizing too, so I want to step back from things. But, you know, I want, more and more people are starting to step up, which is a good thing. But I think that's in any organizing, right? You know, not looking to these individuals. One is because the state does that. They not only attack those individuals to destroy organizations, but it hasn't really worked, you know. It's not really a model, an effective model for organizing, you know, mm-hmm. Or just for change. mm-hmm. So I think that creating horizontalism means collectivizing responsibility too, and creating collective ownership of the organization, mm-hmm. you know.
Do you think in this political context where, you know, there's like austerity coming down and, you know, many cuts to social services that a lot of marginalized people depend on, do you think CropWatch will face a lot more difficulty with involvement and participation?
Our experience is that, we're grassroots organizations. We're already working with nothing, you know. If you have a situation where people are having to survive, you know, then they're not really going to have time to be involved and stuff. But at the same time, like CropWatch, if you think about it, it's a self-defense tactic, but it's also a survival tactic, because the police are killing people and there is a necessity for it. I mean, police brutality isn't going away, you know what I mean? And it's not going to go away unless we make it go away, you know? So I feel that the more they cut social services too, the more it's going to make people realize that shit needs to change, you know? Mm-hmm. And more people are going to get angry. But it's not just going to happen on its own, you know what I mean? I think it's our job as organizers to go out there and kind of like get people and galvanize people and agitate people to, you know, to get organized, you know?
So how does CropWatch, or I guess, and also RAC generally, address community safety? So the understanding that, you know, you want to be, have like police-free zones, from mm-hmm. what I understand, mm-hmm. And that police don't keep communities safe. But then how do you deal with perpetrators of violence?
Yeah.
And I guess specifically, because I know you did, I missed it, but I know you talked about gang violence.
Yeah.
So what is the vision of community safety?
So I think, you know, I mean, like I said, it's like short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals, right? And the idea that we're going to have cop-free communities, like, in the future, like, you know, it's our goal. But we understand that, you know, people aren't there yet, you know what I mean? We're not there yet. And a lot of people, you know, when there's domestic violence, you know, or gang violence, you know, they feel they need to rely on the state, you know, and we're not going to tell people, oh, don't do that, you know what I mean? That's wrong, you shouldn't do that, you know what I mean? Because we don't have the capacity to deal with those things right now, you know what I mean? So I think right now what we're trying to do, hopefully, is just the education and build the capacity. to have mutual aid programs. For example, RAG has a food program. It's a way kind of like to build community, but also where the community can have power and they're running the program themselves. An example in how things could be different, you know what I mean? So in terms of gang violence, like showing how black and brown folks can be working together in a revolutionary organization, but also provide some real alternatives to the system. You know, if we're not doing that, if we're not we don't have something that's real solid in terms of how can we replace the system with, then why are we talking about getting rid of it? Mm-hmm. Rid of it, you know what I mean? Because otherwise, because we have colonialism and all these things, then things aren't going to be different because people have that capitalist mentality already ingrained in them. So they're going to have capitalist ways of relating to each other. So, you know, through also just changing the way we do work or just the way we interact with people. But in general, like I think in gang violence, it's just, and just in like everything else, it's like the culture, learning from our culture, learning from politicizing people and bringing the culture to them that, you know, is going to empower them or is going to give them knowledge that they do have power to take on, you know, the system and in general. But like, I think we understand it's a process. We're not coming at people with this self-righteous approach that they shouldn't call the police and stuff like that because we don't have an alternative for that. You know, I mean, we don't have the capacity for that. So you know, little by little, we hope that people start relying on themselves. Like, if there's gang violence, how can the community come together and heal, you know, and deal with it? Like all forms of what we call horizontal violence, right? Mm-hmm. How can people start coming together in their own community and deal with it? We also, for example, one other example that we had, it was in Iraq. Before we started the food program, we had a people's assembly, which we learned from the movement in Oaxaca, like indigenous people in Oaxaca. And that was a way that where people from that specific community, after the police attacked the May Day March in 2007, they came out, the police came out and the media came out and some large nonprofits came out and blamed like the anarchists, blamed Cop Watch and blamed young people for the police attacking them or attacking the march, which had a lot of families, a lot of children. And we felt it was pre-planned and we felt that the police were at fault and they were at fault. So most of the community had the same sentiment, had the same feelings about it. So we went out and we talked to people and then we decided, like, we organized like a people's assembly where everybody kind of came together and talked about, one, what happened, all these organizations as well talked about what happened and how we can move forward and what are some of the needs of the community, how can we come together and meet those needs. And that's how the food program came about too, was because, you know, people wanted to build trust in the community and show that, you know, we're Cop Watch and also anarchists aren't the enemy, you know. Even through the program, we popularized just the principles of anarchism or just the principles that we're fighting for, which is like mutual aid, direct democracy. And then the community will say, well, if that's anarchism, this one person in particular said, well, if that's anarchism, then I'm an anarchist. And this is somebody from Guatemala, an immigrant, you know, who learned from that just by the work. I mean, that was beautiful, you know what I mean? And that's what we're trying to build, you know? And that's when we talk about community organizing and building community autonomy and building collective ownership, that was a clear example to me.
Actually, just one clarifying question is, just because you mentioned nonprofits, but does Cop Watch and RAC, do you have relationships with other revolutionary organizations or nonprofits?
Yeah, we do work with other organizations. We have alliances, you know? Mm-hmm. And more so, I think we have alliances, they're nonprofits, we have alliances with individuals. Like, there's nonprofits that do like police brutality work. For example, in downtown LA in Skid Row, they do like cop watching work, and they've done it for a while too. And we have a relationship with the people that do cop watching, they're members of Cop Watch. And that's, but overall, like, we're pretty critical of the nonprofit industrial complex, you know? And we challenge it, and I mean, not in a, you know, sometimes it becomes antagonistic. Some people get defensive. You know, that's the only reason why it becomes antagonistic, you know, when we call it out, we criticize it. But reality is that they've attacked us, you know. A lot of these nonprofits work, some of the larger nonprofits work with the police and work with the mayor. And once May Day happened, they divided, like, the people that work with the police and the people that don't, you know. And some of the nonprofits that work with young people also got attacked, and those are the ones we kind of work with, or at least their membership we work with. It just shows when things like that happen, And then you see who really is on the side of the people, who's really on the side of the police and the state.
Can you describe, sorry, because you mentioned it, what happened during that May Day? Because it seems like a pivotal moment.
For RAC and Cop Watch, I would say, because like before that, there was a lot of attention on Cop Watch because we helped expose a lot of like police brutality cases, and they became like international news. So like there was a lot of attention, which I don't think was a good thing necessarily. Mm-hmm. Because they brought down more heat on the organization before we can actually deal with it. I think we're still like young. I mean, not necessarily young, but new. You know, because all of us are young, and it doesn't matter. You know, we could have still been able to deal with it. But I think it was just a matter of that. You know, we weren't prepared to deal with maybe some of the repression or some of the internal stuff that will come about it. You know. Once May Day happened, like they had asked us to go out. There was a huge, like every year before that, there was a huge May Day march. But like it was these nonprofits, in my opinion, try to co-op May Day, which was the International Workers' Day. It came through struggle. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because like those people don't even know the history, I guess, because they came out and even attacked the anarchists just like they did back in Chicago, you know what I mean? So it was just, to me, it was funny, you know? And a lot of people saw the same like correlations, I guess, like, but that year the year before, there was a law they were trying to pass throughout the US, and it was this anti-immigration law. Mm-hmm. And people just came out to the streets, you know. It was like we saw some of the largest marches in the history, you know, of the US, and it wasn't even activists, it was just families, it was people that were going to be affected by it, you know. It's HB 4437, I think. It was March 25th. It was the first big marches that happened. And it was LA. We had like 500,000 people or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was big all over the US and all the cities. But then in May, it was building up to May 1st, where it was like people were calling for like a general strike even. They were saying, we're going to have a general strike and nobody's going to go to work. You know, nobody's going to go work that day. Poor truckers were saying the same thing. They were going to go on general strike. And it was huge like support for it. And it was like part of like even the mainstream radio stations, for like the Spanish-speaking radio and Spanish-speaking television, mm-hmm. were promoting it, or at least helping promote it. And then people just came out on May 1st 2006, and it was a million people in just the LA. Mm-hmm. Like over a million people. It was like just the streets were packed, and the cops were just of course not able to deal with it, you know. I mean, not able to of course they were outnumbered, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was two marches on May Day. There was one in downtown and one in MacArthur Park, which is a historically it's a large Central American community, and that's where another march happened. But it seemed like that march too was even co-opted by the city, like the mayor, it had the mayor speak or something like that at it. So it was just a joke, you know. SCAF, we had our own action that day, where we went up to the detention center, the immigration detention center, and we had like just like, I guess, a forum or something like that, you know. They were still significant because there were millions of people out in the streets, you know, and it was like the largest march in U.S. history, probably. And the year after, like even that year, right, towards the end of that march in MacArthur Park, the police started attacking some of the street vendors. Mm-hmm. And the history of that area too is that people have this experience that all the street vendors get attacked, you know, and it's just like people that are trying to survive basically can't get jobs, and they sell like tamales or just food in the street. Mm-hmm. And it's just Central American, and they're Central American women, a lot of them, and they're really well organized, like self-organized. Mm-hmm. You know, they like watch out for each other, like they have lookouts and everything. Mm-hmm. And the police attack them a lot and steal their money and steal their equipment, just throw their shit out on the street. You start attacking them, and it provoked like people to like fight and resist that. And then people started, like, it was a little rebellion that year, in 2006, towards the end of that march. Mm-hmm. One of my friends was arrested. I almost got arrested. Like, they grabbed my shirt, and I kind of slipped out the shirt, so they weren't able to arrest me. But that year was really powerful, right? And the police attacked it, but the people weren't able to really control the people. It was just a way to intimidate folks from coming out again, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The following year, I felt like it was already planned. Like, they were already planning to attack it. They were afraid, you know. Mm-hmm. They were afraid that was going to grow into a popular movement. Mm-hmm. And it was capable of actually making some fundamental changes and really taking back some, like, you know, really fighting the system and being able to basically, one, outnumber the police, but really, like, you know, grow into something really large, you know. People in power in general, I think, were afraid, and felt like they needed to repress it. They needed to intimidate people from coming out. So they already had the plan to attack that march in 2007. And we were asked to do like cop watching at that march to film the police. And we went out there to do that. Like we weren't there to do security. You know what I mean? I think people were like, well, you guys were there to do security, blah, blah, blah. And then the police started like just pushing people, pushing a lot of our members, like just knocking people over. They're already planning to like provoke something to happen. And then people, like a lot of the anarchists, pushing a lot of the anarchists, like a lot of the anarchists started linking arms, you know what I mean? And saying like, kind of like creating a blockade between them and then like some indigenous dancers that they had ran through with their motorcycles and almost hit like this little girl. Yeah. So like people have created this barricade between the police and the dancers, and that's when the police started attacking them. And started pushing people with their bikes and the batons, and they brought in the riot police and started shooting rubber bullets and tear gas. And some people resisted, some people like fought back, some anarchists, and some other youth, just people from that community. But then the media and the police came out saying that it was their fault, that they are the ones that had provoked the police.
Right.
And that's what they came out to say. And then some mainstream immigrant rights organizations came out and said the same thing. But I mean, the good thing is that a lot of the more like grassroots people, or just even some nonprofit immigrant rights people, don't really work with those organizations anymore too. So it kind of like showed that they're not really on the side of the people, you know. And that's where the People's Assembly came from too, and then the food program.
Okay.